Fiance, Anine, Boujou. Hello and welcome. This is Unreserved. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. This week on Unreserved, we're going back in time, baby. Way back to one of our very first episodes of this space for Indigenous voices. Why? Well, I'm glad you asked. Because Unreserved turns 10 years old this year. And we're looking back at how far we've come and getting excited about where we're going.
Yeah, let's be unreserved.
Danse Rosanna, my dear friend.
Aniro, what a nice introduction.
Dante, Sagyamasi. I missed you so much. Thanks for having me back.
Things have changed a lot in 10 years. A different format, different team, different theme song. But what's still the same is our commitment to telling Indigenous stories Indigenously and welcoming everyone into the circle. Let's walk down memory lane and hear how many of the stories from our first season still resonate today, and how others represent a marked change in how Indigenous people are represented in media across Turtle Island. The year is 2014, when I was a younger deer child. Welcome to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, the show that takes you behind the headlines of Canada's top trending Indigenous stories. I'm your host, Rosanna Deerchild, a top Indigenous in my own mind. If this is your first time listening to us and you're thinking, how on earth did I not know this show existed? I am so freaking excited. Well, I like your enthusiasm. But this is actually only our second episode ever. So for those of you who joined us last week, welcome back. For those of you who are just tuning in, let me fill you in on what Unreserved is all about. Here on Unreserved, we recognize that Canada is changing. Indigenous voices are growing stronger, and the people, places, and issues, once hidden in plain sight, are now the talk of the nation. So this place is a new space that we are making together. On Unreserved, we'll bring you Aboriginal stories from the four directions of the country. We'll introduce you to new faces, places, culture, politics, and ideas from an Indigenous view. More than a new show, Unreserved is a meeting ground where we're all in the circle. So without reservation, welcome Boujou, Anine, and Tanse. Today on Unreserved,
you've inherited something very powerful. There's no easy way to say it.
Spit it out!
You're Kagagi.
Move on over, Spider-Man. We'll meet the guy who is responsible for bringing a new Aboriginal superhero to the forefront. Calling all stargazers, we've all heard of the Big Dipper and the North Star, but what about the Sweat Lodge? Find out how you can see Cree constellations. And tired of seeing negative depictions of Indigenous peoples, Winnipeg artist Casey Adams is taking new pictures to challenge the public's perception. Memories. Good times. That was the intro to Unreserved circa October 2014. At the time, we also had a weekly appearance from somebody you might recognize, Cree journalist Connie Walker. She was the CBC's lead reporter in what was then called the Aboriginal Unit, now CBC Indigenous. The idea was to give a little more context and background to some of the Indigenous news across the country. In this next segment, we'll hear about the climax of a precedent-setting story out of Brantford, Ontario. Connie was covering a court case prompted by McMaster Children's Hospital. The hospital was asking for the Children's Aid Society to force an 11-year-old Indigenous girl to undergo chemotherapy. In the end, the court did not rule in favor of the hospital. Instead, her mother's plan to seek traditional healing to treat the cancer was upheld by the court. Here's where things were at as of October 16, 2014, about a month before the final ruling. Hi, Connie.
Hi, Rosanna.
So you've been following the case of a First Nations girl and her family rejecting chemo and McMaster Hospital going to court to force her back into treatment. Can you give us a quick summary?
Well, essentially, if that sounds familiar, it's because it is familiar. 4 months ago, Michaela Salt, another First Nations girl from the New Credit First Nation, was in a very similar position as this young girl whose details we're hearing in court today. Now, in Michaela's case, when CAS investigated, they decided that they would not intervene and that she and her family would be free to pursue traditional Indigenous medicine. However, in this case, McMaster has taken CAS to court, and they're trying to force the family back into treatment, into chemotherapy treatment. Now, the family is actually currently not even in the country. They're not taking part in the court proceedings. They're at a holistic health institute in Florida receiving naturopathic treatments for this deadly disease.
Now, yesterday, a publication ban on court proceedings was lifted. What can you tell us about what's been happening inside the courtroom?
Well, a lot of the nitty-gritty details have been testified to in court over the last week. Doctors from McMaster have gotten into quite detailed descriptions of the young girl's diagnosis and prognosis. They said that if she continued with her chemotherapy treatment, she would have a 90 to 95% chance of survival. But the longer that's delayed, that percentage goes down. And if she doesn't return to treatment at all, that she has zero chance of survival. We've also heard from Indigenous medicine experts who spoke to their experience about being witness to how traditional medicine has been used to treat various forms of cancers in communities for years, and about the efficacy of traditional medicine. And today, Andrew Koster, the director of Branch Children's Aid Society, is on the stand defending their decision not to intervene in this case.
So why is this story so important, Connie?
Well, I think that it's obviously incredibly important because, they say that a life of a little First Nations girl is at stake here. And that's why McMaster has gone to court. They say that without this action that her life will be lost. But I think this is also important, going back to Michaela Salt, I think there's been some speculation that if Ms. McMaster is successful in this application at court, and if the judge rules in their favor, that may have implications for Michaela and her family, who right now have been, essentially free to pursue their own traditional medicine. But also, I did an interview with this young girl's mother, who, because of a publication ban, I'm not actually allowed to identify her name. And she said, this case is so important because it speaks to the rights of Indigenous people and the Indigenous right to choose your own treatment. And she said, she doesn't actually recognize the court proceedings that are happening here today, and that's why she's not participating in them, because she doesn't feel they have any jurisdiction over her inherent right to choose her own medical treatment for her and her daughter. So I think there are, a number of reasons why these proceedings are so important.
Thank you so much, Connie.
You're welcome, Rosanna.
That was Connie Walker from October 2014. She's Cree from Okanis First Nation in Saskatchewan and a former CBC journalist, now working for Gimlet Media, a podcast division inside of Spotify. Her investigative podcast, Stolen, recently won a Peabody Award and a Pulitzer Prize. Yes, that's Pulitzer. Sis has mad storytelling skills. And we've got big plans for a season-ender party extravaganza in June. Connie's definitely on the honored guest list. Make sure to follow along with the show and stay part of our Facebook family for more info about that. Let's get back to our show's second ever episode. We're about to hear some music from George Leach. And we'll meet a brand new superhero on the scene. Well, at least he was brand new 10 years ago. Let's check out some music from one of Turtle Island's hottest artists. And I really mean that. George Leach is a singer, songwriter, and guitarist from Lillooet, BC. Over the past year, his guitar, blues, rock has been burning up award shows with a Juno win for his album Surrender. And most recently, he took home 3 Aboriginal People's Choice Music Awards. This song is called Carry Me.
Shackles on my feet, I'm deep now.
Well, if you insist, I guess I could carry you. No worries, George Leach. That's Carry Me from George's award-winning album, Surrender. You're listening to Unreserved, the radio show that tells you what the cool kids are doing in Indigenous Canada. I'm Rosanna Deerchild, super Indigenerd. It's my superhero identity. What? Who doesn't pretend they're a superhero once in a while? Don't even lie. Well, at least some of us did. People like Jay Ojig. Unfortunately, Aboriginal superheroes, not always cool. When Ojig was a kid, there was a character on the TV cartoon Super Friends. This character learned the power of his people from an elder.
What do we do?
Time has come to test your manhood, young one. One sprinkle of this ancient Indian powder, and you will be able to handle the grizzly without weapons. You have only to cry out the word, Inukjuk, and you will be the most powerful brave of all. Inukjuk!
That never works, by the way. Apache Chief and his Indian powder of the 70s might not be considered one of the finest moments in superheroics. But flash forward to 2014. Jay Ojig creates a new Aboriginal superhero.
You've inherited something very powerful. There's no easy way to say it.
Spit it out!
You're Kigagi.
Who?
Kigagi. The Raven. You don't speak Anishinaabeg? You're the only one who can stop them. Channel your power. Get angry, son.
And so it is. Kigagi is born. And he is awesome. Artist and graphic novelist Jay Ojig is from the Kitiganzibi Anishinaabeg First Nation in Quebec. Jay has seen his creation go from the comic book to animation. Kigagi is the star of a new TV show coming to Aboriginal People's Television Network, or APTN, tomorrow. Jay Ojig joined CBC Ottawa's All in a Day host, Alan Neal.
Can you describe for people what is happening when Kigagi transforms, when he becomes the hero?
Kigagi is basically... It's a bit of a different take on superheroics, apart from just having a First Nations or Algonquin bent. It's kind of like a horror twist, a supernatural twist that I think is lacking. So instead of fighting supervillains, he's fighting monsters. He's fighting creatures. And what happens is he unleashes this power that he's inherited that makes him a champion of his people in Anishinaabe, which literally means the people. And he becomes this hero. And the reason he becomes a superhero is because that's what, to him, a hero looks like. He's a modern kid, grew up watching Spider-Man, Batman, and that stuff. So when he becomes a hero, he becomes what he's familiar with.
It's through his lens, is what a hero means to him. There's a mention there of tapping into his anger. So is the character's power born out of anger?
Basically what it is that as he's going through these changes, it's having effects on his personality and how he conducts himself. And one of the things is it's leading to temper flare-ups. It's just him kind of adjusting to change, which we're using, I would say, as kind of a metaphor for what he's going through in life. As a teenage boy, he's going through, you know, these mood swings and things. We don't really have anyone, any grizzlies, test our mettle as First Nations people or sprinkle Indian powder on us. But just like any other kid, you know, we go through these changes. And we're using the metamorphosis into a superhero to kind of examine that and play it out writ large on the screen.
How different is that from when Jay Ojik gets angry? Is that when you find your power usually?
I think the difference is that when Kigagi gets angry, people care. When I get angry, people are just like, yeah, we'll call you back. It's you know.
Tell me a little bit about Jay Ojik as a kid. Wait, Apache Chief is on television. Maybe the characters at Alpha Flight, you're able to see the Aboriginal characters. Were there other Aboriginal superheroes around you?
That I can recall, no. And that was part of the reason why I did what I did when I started doing comics. I started self-publishing black and white books as low rent an operation as you can have, just based on what I could put together. And the reason why was because I got into comics pretty heavy when I was very, very young, like 4 or 5 years old. And my mother says I started writing stories at around 5. I don't recall that. My memory's not that great. I don't even remember what I had for breakfast this morning. But... that's what I'm told. So basically the idea was I got really into these things, and we didn't see, my brother and I, we didn't see any characters that look like us. And so we started kind of sketching, creating our own little characters of like what we would, you know, what we would be like if we grew up and became superheroes, basically, if I'm gonna be honest about it. You know, that's kind of what kids do. And over time, it kind of morphed and it became different things. And I just kind of looked at it as like, all right, let's take a shot at it. Let's try doing a comic and create something that First Nations kids can look at and say, hey, this is our guy. And at the same time, non-Native readers can look at it and say, hey, that's pretty cool. You know, it's not exclusive in that way.
I would imagine part of what was frustrating about some of the characters when they were introduced, certainly I say this as a non-Aboriginal reader of comics, you would read them and the characters always, the powers or their identity was always tied completely to who they were as an Aboriginal individual. You didn't, when you say, I am Apache chief, there was no guy walking in and saying, I am white United Church individual. Like it was always tied to who they were rather than their power. And I wonder what that was like for you as a reader.
I think for us, it was basically just, you know, we looked at something like, you know, say for example, Spider-Man, where he's just basically a guy. He gets bitten by a spider and he gains the powers of, you know, mm-hmm. Whatever they say, a proportionate spider. I guess a 6-foot spider would be able to lift cars. So for us, it was kind of just like, basically, if we're going to have First Nations superheroes, why couldn't he be Wolverine? Why couldn't he be the Hulk? Why couldn't he be, you know, why would it necessarily have to be an intrinsic deal that would be related to his race or anything like that, his religion? Let's face it, when we look at, say, Batman with Bruce Wayne, we don't know what his racial heritage, what his background is. We know he's European, but we don't know from where.
Right.
We don't know his religious beliefs. We don't know his political leanings, even though, let's face it, we all kind of know he's conservative.
In a Wayne manner, that it's a purely conservative environment altogether.
He's a big industrialist, you know. It's him and Tony Stark, man. That's what they do.
I had a look at the trailer today. It looks like it's going to be a lot of fun. But I noticed the character did go through some transformations here. Can you describe how different he looks on screen than for somebody who's picked up your graphic novel?
Well, in terms of the television series, I wrote and drew the graphic novel that the show is based on.
Mm-hmm.
And I sat down and I was like, all right, well, we need character designs for the show. And I was like, let's just use the character designs from the book because that's what they look like. And so I basically, you know, drew the same thing. And for me, I'm coming into something new. And the show itself is a computer-generated, computer graphic, mm-hmm. you know, 3D animation. It's not hand-drawn animation. There's certain rules and certain things that come with that. And I don't know much about that world. I was acclimating myself at that time. And I handed the animators this, you know, perfectly nice little drawing of a guy with long hair. And he has these tassels on his wrists and they're long and flowy. And our animators were like, well, we can't do that stuff. That's going to cost a lot of money. And I was like, really? So I guess they have to animate each strand of hair individually. And they were looking at me like, we're not doing Kung Fu Panda. That thing took like 5 or 6 years. So he decided to get a little modern Kagagi, and he started looking into ponytails. We went out and we made a 3D animated scrunchie and put that on the back of his hair, and he rocks the ponytail now.
So he's got shorter hair and wings as well, because he needed more stuff to take place in the sky. So
that was another thing was if you read the comic, which is still available through Arcana, if you go to our website, just a little plug. Just go and search Kagagi there. Basically, the majority of it takes place, a lot of it takes place in the forest. And he's like kind of swinging through trees on those tassels and running around fighting monsters. And again, the animators are like, trees are pretty tough to do. Is there a way we can have the majority action take place in the sky? And I was like, well, Kagagi means the raven. So it organically makes sense if he has wings. So in the TV show, he has wings.
he's got wings.
That's how it's not superheroes. A bad thing. That's how it, you know, you can just write that in. Like, well, now we need him to have wings. So he grew wings.
Wings, totally awesome. Cape. I don't need your stinking cape. I got wings. That's why I'm not a superhero. Too much ego. Jay Ojig is the creator of Kagagi the Raven, an Aboriginal superhero, who will become an animated series on APTN starting tomorrow at 10 a.m. Well, it's only fitting, after talking about superheroes, to play a song by a superhero, sort of. Superman is a member of the Crow Nation. He fuses his culture's music with hip-hop. An impossible mix? Not to Superman. This week, the very popular website Upworthy featured one of his unique songs. Here's Superman with Prayer Loop Song.
Drop the kids off and go party gets me mad. So I pray, pray for peace and pray for change. Keep on praying when everything stays the same. And I pray for the pastors and all of the churches and those who cry night song following hearses. I pray for you, pray for the sick and the poor. Pray for the rich man who don't give to the Lord. And I pray for wisdom and I pray for power. And I pray for be ready in the final hour. And I pray for those who keep judging ministry. And I pray for my friends and my enemies.
That is Superman from the Crow Nation. And I'm Rosanna Dearchild, looking back on 10 years of Unreserved. The episode you're hearing right now was recorded in October of 2014. Back then, we were the little team that could, collecting the top Indigenous stories from across CBC and bringing them together under one umbrella. That's why you'll hear several other hosts in our earlier shows, like in this next segment with the morning show host from Winnipeg. Marcy Marcusa chats with my friend Casey Adams about her transformative art. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, getting to know the movers and shakers behind Canada's top trending Indigenous stories. I'm Rosanna Dearchild, and I move, I shake, and I groove. Just not all at the same time, because I don't want to pull a muscle. Casey Adams is a Winnipeg artist who is challenging you to change your view about Indigenous peoples. Her latest project is a series of portraits she calls Perception. Casey spoke with CBC Manitoba's Marcy Marcusa on Information Radio.
Let's talk about the project, Perception. How did it come about?
It has been in the works for a very, very long time. I realized that, you know, most of us, we make snap judgments and sometimes it can be hurtful. And what I wanted to do is I wanted to give a voice to people who you don't hear about in the Indigenous community. And that would be the people who are, you know, not in the news, the people who are holding down a job. They have a mortgage. They're paying taxes. They put themselves through school. You don't hear about them in the news.
Yeah, the pictures are all people's faces, community members' faces. And in one picture, the person is stoic, looking, serious looking, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And the second picture, they smile and their whole face opens up and they're quite close up. Yes. Can you give us an example, though, of the captions you've used to sort of contrast those two images?
Well, I think what's important, which I don't really talk too much about, but in the process, what I do is I ask the model to look at the camera and I start asking them questions. I start saying, okay, now I want to imagine what it would be like if somebody called you a drunk or a dirty Indian or something like that, throwing racist comments at you. And I get immediate reaction. And then those are the images that I've captured. Then I turn around and I say, the one, Maegan, I asked him, think about your fiance. And immediately that first shot I got was his smile. I mean, and so it's really about capturing really how they see themselves. And
I'm laughing out of joy because I'm looking at some of these photos while you're saying that. And I could see how a person's face would change. So the first photo, this is Leah Gazan's, just for an example for the listeners. It says lazy Indian with a question mark. Look again. And you click to the second photo, which is Leah Gazan. And it says a mother, sister, auntie, professor, community leader, social activist, and circuit training goddess.
She is. She certainly is. She is the least laziest person I've ever met in my entire life. So we kind of worked on that title together. It was her that chose it.
One more example, because I think there's so powerful, the contrast. Tax burden, look again. And this is Brendan Manikizic, a husband, father, sun dancer, defender of treaty rights, homeowner, and a Golden Jubilee Medal recipient.
That's
and
right.
His face is blown up with a smile.
He actually wanted me to put in a great cuddler. But I said all the ladies would be going after him. So I said that for the sake of his wife, I decided not to put that one in.
How challenging is it to change the public's perception of Indigenous people?
Well, you know, honestly, I think it has to happen at home. And I think that's the reason why I did this piece was if we, every single person takes that, just that one step and just trying to change our perception. I know when I was growing up as a teenager, I used to think the same way. Being Indigenous, I felt the same way, which is kind of terrible to think.
You felt the same way as sort of the stereotypes in the first pictures?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And because I'm generations raised with shame. Shame of who I am and where I come from. And it's taken many people in the community, many friends, and teaching me how wrong that was. And so I'm trying to make amends.
How important is the admission of that?
It was very difficult. I often tell people I came out of the Aboriginal closet, and I've been trying to stand up and be proud of where I come from, and I'm trying to be a role model to others out there, and especially within my family too. You know, many generations of guilt and shame out there.
Here's how I'm going to say goodbye to you. I'm going to read yours. You ready?
Yes.
Here's your face looking serious and dismayed. It says, Squaw, look again. Casey Adams, OG Cree, a wife, mother, twin, artist, educator, homeowner, taxpayer, curler, who paid for university herself. Thanks for coming in this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Maybe you can teach me how to curl.
Casey Adams is a Winnipeg artist. That's a 2014 interview between her and Information Radio host Marcy Marcusa. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, we dug deep, deep in the archive for a special encore presentation of Unreserved. It's our second show ever for a national audience. That was 10 years ago, and creator, I was nervous. But listening to these first days on the show makes me also a little nostalgic. It makes me realize how far we've come as Indigenous storytellers. Back then, we were just beginning to claim space and reclaim our voices. It was a steep climb. Now, just a decade later, we are everywhere. Radio, podcasts, big and small screens, and of course, music. Songs are just one way we share our stories, from people like Lila Gilday. The Northern Songstress is one of many we have shared over the years. Don't This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, the show that tells you stories from an Indigenous view. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Speaking of Indigenous views, what do you see when you look up at the night sky? The North Star? Or maybe you recognize the Big Dipper, the Little Dipper, and Orion's Belt. But when Wilf Buck looks up, he sees very different stars and constellations. He sees Going Home Star, the Fisher Stars, and the Sweat Lodge, to name but a few. Cree stars. I like the sound of that. I wonder if there is a deer star. Mr. Buck is a science educator with the Manitoba First Nations Education Resource Center, and he is Cree from the Apaskwayek Cree Nation. He took CBC Manitoba's weekend morning show host, Terry McLeod, on a tour of his Cree stellations.
How did you first discover that the constellations that Cree people saw were different from the ones that people in the South saw?
Well, what initially got me started was a elder named Murdo Scribe from Norway House. And one of the legends he was talking about was had to do with the Big Dipper mythology called Ochi Kajagosuk, the Fisher Stars. And that legend talks about at one point we didn't have no summer in this part of the world. And so Ochik, the fisher, went down with some of his buddies down south because he heard there was summer down south. And he went and bought a piece of summer back for us. And a lot of anthropologists liken this to an actual living memory of when there was actually no summer in this part of the world, something called the Ice Age.
So these fisher stars, you mean the fisher the animal, not fisher the person who fishes?
Fisher the animal, yeah.
So when you look up, or when he looked up, Murdo Scribe, mm-hmm. he didn't see the Big Dipper, he saw the fisher stars.
Right, exactly, yeah, because that's what he was taught.
Wow.
That's what got me intrigued with this, because I was just listening to what he had to say, and then I realized that everybody in the Northern Hemisphere looked up at night at the same group of stars. So therefore, everybody must have their own interpretations of these stars, because at that time, there was no mass communication, so a lot of people didn't hear about Roman and Greek mythology. Those thought processes going through my head, I started asking more about the various constellations to a lot of the elders in the ceremony. And a lot of these relate to the ceremony. As part of the ceremony, they identify groups of stars and constellations.
So which other ones then? Because there are a whole array of paintings down the hallway here.
So these ones here are the Pleiades in Star Maps, the Seven Sisters. And this here tells a story, the legend of Atsagosisqueo, Star Woman. One of the First Nations beliefs is that we originate from the stars. We're star people. And we come here to learn in this physical form, to learn and experience things that beings of energy is what we are. We call these Atsagosak in my language. And inside of us, we have something called Atsak, which is the spirit. So we're related to the stars in that way.
I feel like I've seen this star before on star blankets and such.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, this when Star Woman came down, she bought with her the original star blanket. But as you can see on the painting here, the depiction, this star has 7 points, and it represents the 7 stars that are visible to the naked eye in the sky. And originally, these were painted on buffalo hides, bear hides, moose hides, all kinds of hides. But with the introduction of cloth, they tried to sew a 7-pointed star, and they found that it was very difficult to do. It took a long time. But they also found that if they used even number points, then they could fold the star in half and even the halves out against each other, and it would be a lot less time-consuming. And so nowadays, your stars, you'll see, are 8 points, 12 points, 16 points, 24 points.
Now, this one behind us, this looks like a goose.
Yes, this is called Nisqa. And Nisqa flies in the goose's path, Nisqa Meskino. The goose's path is the Milky Way. And this is equivalent to Cygnus, the swan. You can see the Northern Cross right here.
Yes.
And so the reason they call this Nisqa and they call them Milky Way Niskamiskino, was during the fall and the spring when the migratory birds were flying. At nighttime, you could hear the geese flying at night, and sometimes they'd look up in the sky and they'd see the silhouette moving across that path, the Milky Way.
Fascinating that you can look up into the sky and see different constellations than the ones that I've been taught to see.
One of the things I tell the students, like, we attend about 55 schools in Manitoba, band operating schools, and the very first thing before I start my presentation, I talk to the students and tell them that every culture under the sky had their own stories about the sky. In Inuk, the Cree people were no different. The Romans and Greeks were the lucky ones who got put into school curriculum, but everybody understood about the stars.
So this one here?
This one here is the Pleiades again. And in this depiction, this legend, they talk about a group of stars in the sky, usually in the fall time and in the winter time. There's the Sweat Lodge.
You mean there's a constellation in the shape of a sweat lodge?
Yeah, yeah,
can we walk down and have a look at that?
So this is the Sweat Lodge. And I guess the equivalent with Roman Greek mythology is the Corona Borealis. And so the Sweat Lodge is in the sky, usually in the fall time and in the winter time. And if you look at up in the sky in those times of year, you can see the Sweat Lodge, you can see the altar, which is the North Star, and you can see the sacred fire, which are the Sweat Lodge rocks, which are the Pleiades. So you'll see them in a line right across the sky.
Now, the star that, you know, European-derived people, the star that we call the North Star, you have a different name for it, right?
Yes, we do, yeah.
What do you call it?
Well, there's various names depending on what it is you're talking about, what point is to be made. One of the common names is Kiweitin. Kiweitin, the root word for Kiweitin is Kiwe, which means home. So the Kiweitin is the going home star. And the reason that is because that's the only star that's stationary in the sky, which is stationary pretty much above the northern direction.
And how is it used as a going home star?
So once you find the northerly direction, you can pretty much find any other direction. So at nighttime, if they see the North Star and they wanted to go east, they'd keep the North Star on their left shoulder, and they know they'd be traveling east. And any other direction, they just move around and make sure that star was in the direction that they wanted to go.
This has been such a pleasure to learn, and so much to learn. I'm so grateful to you for this, Mr. Buck.
Thank you very much for asking me to do this.
That's Wilfred Buck with former CBC Manitoba host Terry McLeod. Wilfred still comes around, and he's still looking up at the stars. In fact, we just had him on the show last season, alongside our interview with Indigenous astronaut Nicole Mann. Nicole is a member of the Wailaiki of the Round Valley Indian Tribes. In October of 2022, she rocketed into orbit, 20 years after Chickasaw astronaut John Harrington became the first Indigenous person in space. Nicole spent 157 days on the International Space Station as the mission commander. That's where they conduct research and experiments to prepare for explorations to the Moon and Mars. Here's part of our conversation from 2023, just a few months after Nicole returned to Earth.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1,
ignition, engines full power, and lift off. Nicole, welcome back to Earth and to Unreserved.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back on our planet.
I have to say that as a lifelong Star Trek nerd, Trekkie, this is like a huge privilege and an honor to speak with you today. You might be able to see I'm actually wearing my TNG space badge.
I noticed. It's looking very good.
Boop, boop. In honor of you.
Thank you.
So take us to your floating laboratory. You spent 5 months there. Describe that, well, space for us.
Oh, it's absolutely incredible. You know, I thought about it so much before going to space. You know, what was it going to be like? I set all these expectations, and all those expectations were absolutely exceeded. It was just incredible. Living and working on board the International Space Station, not only are we doing some incredible science on board and maintenance upgrades to the space station, but it is so much fun just floating around in space. It feels like if you've ever had a dream when you were a kid that you were flying or floating, it feels just like that. It really does.
Oh, I imagine it does. like feel amazing. I can't even imagine. And as you said, your team conducted hundreds of experiments. Can you walk us through a couple of the kinds of experiments you did?
Absolutely. There's so many different experiments. A couple of my favorites, one is the biofabrication facility, or BFF. And this is where we are literally 3D printing human cells in space. And it sounds like a Star Trek type situation, right? But this is the reality now. It's because we're in microgravity, this laboratory, we can print the cells and they will grow and their structure will be more accurate than they would if you were printing them on Earth, because of the gradient of gravity, because you have to have a structure that would interfere with the cell growth, because you have thermal gradients. You don't have any of this in space. And the concept is in the future, perhaps we can print a patch for your heart. So if you had a heart attack, you know, that muscle will not heal completely. And so we could patch the heart, or we could at some point maybe print 3D organs and fly those back to Earth where they could be transplanted. So there's that side of it. There's also a lot of robotics. We have these little flying robots called astrobees, and the little astrobees fly off each other with sensors. And the concept is that that can help astronauts in some of their daily activities. And that's future development for when we go to the moon and eventually Mars. It's going to be a combination of humans and robots really working together. And we've got to grow plants on board too. We grow dwarf tomatoes. It was incredible to smell the soil and to smell the plants, because the smell on station is a very sterile environment. It smells a little bit, you know, very like metallic, like a hospital, with some of the cleaning solutions that we use. And so it was really amazing to smell plant life and see these beautiful little red tomatoes.
That's very cool. I'm pretty sure I saw those episodes on Star Trek.
you might have. Yes, they're a reality now.
I'm sure it's a lot more complicated than that. How does doing those kinds of experiments in space help us to prepare for future exploration?
So some of this is technology development, and we're trying to develop you know, ways that we can sustain humans deeper into space. So perhaps that's when we have human presence, sustained presence on the lunar surface, or this journey to Mars, we could grow tomatoes. We also on board grew a yogurt and grew yeast to try to develop ways and where we could be self-sufficient in our food and our nutrients. And so not only if we can grow some of our food on these long missions, that will provide nutrients for our body, but there's also the psychological aspect of growing plants and kind of still being connected with your home planet while you're on a deep space exploration.
Wow, that's wonderful. I can't even grow tomatoes on the Earth, so that's really impressive to me.
We have help. We have help from the scientists on the ground, thankfully. Lots of help.
You had mentioned earlier that it's like, you know, floating, literally, when you have dreams of floating and flying. But can you tell us what it was like living day to day on the International Space Station? Take me through what your typical day would be.
Your day, typically I woke up around 6 o'clock to just prepare for the day, eat breakfast, do your hygiene, look over your activities for the day. And at 7:30, typically that kind of kicks off the day. We have what's called a morning DPC with all of the mission controls throughout the world and all astronauts on board, just kind of, hey, review, this is the plan. Are there any changes to the plan? And then your time is literally 5 minute increments, boom, 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 you're scheduled. You have an hour for lunch in the middle. You have 2.5 hours of exercise, which includes time to change your clothes and to clean up after exercise. And that goes until 7:30 at night, when you have the evening DPC again with all the mission control centers. So your days are so busy, but they're so fun and so engaging and so different every day. Maybe you'll be doing science in the morning, and then you're doing perhaps a video chat with some school children in the afternoon. And then you're fixing the toilet in the evening, you know, and you're doing another type of a science experiment later on. So it keeps you certainly engaged and excited every day. And I found that your body doesn't get tired. You know, if you have a long day at work, sometimes you get home, you're like, oh, I just need to lay down, I'm so tired. Your body doesn't get tired because you're literally floating around all day, but your mind will get tired. You can notice that your mind will fatigue if you have long days, day after day after day. And so it's important that you take care of your mind as well. And you take some of those mental breaks, and you have a break on the weekend. You can just look out the window, or maybe read a book, or or just spend some time to recharge yourself. So it's an important aspect of space flight that I didn't realize was going to be so significant. It's taking care of your mind as well.
Yeah, self-care is important wherever you are, right?
Absolutely, yes.
And I couldn't imagine reading a book in space. I would just want to stare out the window all the time.
I know. I didn't read a ton. Usually I looked out the window. That was my favorite pastime. I'm looking out the window and taking pictures, trying to capture that view.
Oh, man, that must be impossible to capture something like that.
It is. Yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, photographs and video just cannot do it justice.
Yeah. Did you have time for fun things? For example, I heard you did some space selfies.
I did take some space selfies on the spacewalk, especially on the second. I did two spacewalks. On the first one, it was just so new. I was so focused on just getting everything done. I didn't really take a moment to just reflect and just pause. So I was really intentional about that on the second spacewalk specifically. I wanted to take more photos. And even if it was just for 30 seconds, I want to pause for 30 seconds and just look around. You know, I'm literally climbing outside the space station, holding on with one hand, floating over the planet. I wanted to just live in that moment. And so I was glad that I took a moment to do that.
Nicole Mann is a member of the Wailaiki of the Round Valley Indian Tribes and the first Indigenous woman in space. That interview first played on Unreserved back in June as part of our Star People episode. It's one of many episodes we're celebrating as we head toward the end of our 10th season here on Unreserved. And you've heard this on our show before. You have to know where you come from to know where you're going. And as a show, that means looking back to see just how far we've come. We hope you've enjoyed this little jaunt down memory lane. Look out for brand new episodes of Unreserved starting next week. And make sure to follow us all the way to our very special season finale extravaganza in June. That's all our time on Radio Indigenous. This episode was produced by Kim Kasher, Laura Bone-Stubing, Zoe Tennant, and Rhiannon Johnson. A special 10-year shout-out to the producers on the archival pieces you heard in this episode. That's Kate Friesen, Connie Walker, Maggie Moose, and Ruth Shedd. You could always find more on our website, cbc.ca/unreserved. Download the podcast on the CBC Listen app or your favorite pod places. I'm your favorite cousin, Rosanna Deerchild, coming at you from Winnipeg in Treaty 1 territory. Gnaskanamitnawa. I go say.